The poem I shared at the beginning this morning from Rumi kind of finishes off. He says, "The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." So there's a tremendous wisdom in using the, I think Ruth put it, using the manure to as a pathway, or as pathways, that's a mixed metaphor, as a way of helping us wake up, you know, just kind of opening to what's challenging, what's difficult, what's painful. And when we meet our experience in this different way, something really fundamental shifts. We move out of, you know, many of you know this, we move out of, this should be different, why isn't this different, I need to do something to make it different, to, oh, this is how things are right now. And in that shift, something pretty profound can change. And that really can be a doorway to awakening, to greater freedom in our lives. What I'd like to do is to, in this talk, to talk about difficulties. And in the loving-kindness practice, or in the metta practice, the friendliness practice, we typically have, you know, cultivate kindness and friendliness to a difficult person. And it's important to say that we don't tend to start with the difficult person. We sit down, I'm going to do some loving kindness, and I'm going to bring to mind that person that betrayed me and did all these terrible things to me, and let my heart be open to, you know, and everything's going to be fine. I mean, it doesn't work like that, does it? It really is a training. It's really a practice for opening the heart. And we tend to start where it's somewhat more easy, although with ourselves, it's not always the easiest place, because often we have a lot of judgment and criticism and lack of self-worth and all of that. But it's an important place to start. But also with those that we're close to. And it's like building a muscle. We kind of go outward to where it's more difficult. You don't start weightlifting at, you know, 300 pounds if you haven't yet lifted 100. You know, you kind of work your way up there. So it is a training of the heart and mind. And what I want to do this afternoon in this talk is focus not so much on a difficult person per se, but difficult experiences, particularly difficult experiences coming from the world we're living in. How do we hold those? How do we work with them? How do we use them as a source, really, of waking up, of gaining greater freedom and peace in our lives? And as I've said, this is a training. We can cultivate a heart that, I think Sharon Salzberg put it this way, a heart that's wide as the world, that doesn't exclude anybody, that isn't separate, you know, oh, just these people, oh, no, not those people, but actually takes in everybody. And it's not, for most of us, that's not where we begin, and it's not an easy place to be, but that's what we're cultivating, is that quality of connection, of non-separation, of loving kindness, of friendliness, ultimately to include all beings. And the invitation in this practice of freedom, because I see it as fundamentally, is a practice of freedom. It's a practice of cultivating freedom in our lives. The invitation is to open to everything, to open to the good and the bad and the ugly. And we can, with training and with practice, we can open to anger and guilt and shame and judgment and greed and all of these, what we think of as, ooh, I don't like those, I want to keep them away, I don't want to bring awareness to these unpleasant or difficult emotions. If we do that, then we're never going to be really free, because there's always going to be some part that we don't want to go there. That's too difficult or too painful. There's Carl Jung, the great psychologist, said, what we resist persists. What we resist persists. And Eckhart Tolle, the spiritual teacher, kind of put the other side of that is, and that is that what we accept, we go beyond. What we accept, we go beyond. When we fully open to and allow our experience to really let it in, then it doesn't have its hooks in us anymore. We've shifted that relationship to our experience. We see that the things that we may have been caught up in before, you know, whether it's judgment or shame or some afflictive, painful states, they're not really solid and they're not really who we are. They're just the mind has got kind of hooked on, that's the way I'm seeing things right now. That's the way circumstances and conditions of my life have led me to make certain choices, and I've become somewhat fixated or identified. And that's what it is when we suffer, when we're clinging. We're mistaking things. We're seeing a part of the reality and we're thinking, oh, if only I had this thing or this person, then that would be okay. I mean, and I'm not talking about just a spacious kind of liking, oh, I like this, or I don't like, you know, I'm talking about when we get hooked on. Similarly with aversion, when we're kind of like, oh, you know, got to get that person out of my life. Then there's kind of like a hook. Pema Chodron, the Tibetan Buddhist teacher, talks about it in the Tibetan tradition as Shenpa, S-H-E-N-P-A. It's like a hook that you get caught on, you know, and the mind has become kind of constricted and identified with whatever that the thing is. And the practice is to simply notice that, to bring a kind and non-judging awareness to what's here and just let it in, invite it in. You know, as I said, you know, with Rumi, welcome the guests. Not always easy to welcome the guests, but with training and with practice, we can let them in. And when we do, something profound shifts. The great Thai teacher that Ruth mentioned earlier, Ajahn Chah, put it like this. He said, let go a little and you'll experience a little freedom. Let go a lot and you'll experience a lot of freedom. Let go completely and you'll experience complete freedom and peace in your life. Your struggle with the world will be at an end. I like that last line, your struggle with the world will be at an end. Because so much of our suffering, perhaps all of our suffering, is that we're in a struggle with the world. You know, and the world can be our internal world, but we're in the struggle with the way things are. We're in that relationship of resistance to our experience, and we're kind of hooked on, you know, got to change this, got to get this, you know. And we, with this practice, with this training, both in loving mindfulness and in loving kindness, friendliness, we learn that we can shift that relationship. We can let go a little and experience a little bit of freedom. What about if I just shift my way I'm looking at this person who I think of as so painful and difficult in my life? What if I just bring in some loving kindness? Maybe a space opens up and that shifts and, oh, you know, they're not that bad person that I was thinking about before. That may shift. Let go a lot and there's a lot of freedom, a lot of peace. And it all points to the complete letting go that the Buddha talks about, which is enlightenment, which is awakening, which is complete freedom from suffering. There's no longer any kind of basis for being hooked anymore. It's kind of the work has been done, and that was the Buddha's experience and from the place from which he taught. So the invitation really is to open to everything, to leave no stone unturned. And when we do this, then when we do let go, what naturally happens is the separation between ourselves and others breaks down. It kind of falls away because the illusion, you know, when we're clinging, is that there's separation. There's me and you, and there's like a fundamental difference. If you get what you want, I won't get what I want. When we're in that kind of unwholesome, unskillful relationship. But when that falls away, then what naturally arises is connection, is non-separation, is, in a broad sense, you might call it love, although that might be too kind of airy, but is friendliness, is is connection with others and with all beings. How the great Tibetan teacher Milarepa put it, he said, "Long accustomed to contemplating compassion, I have forgotten all difference between myself and others. Long accustomed to contemplating compassion, I have forgotten all difference between myself and others." It's like just through this practice of loving kindness, friendliness, compassion, then there's a natural falling away, that sense of separation, that, you know, I'm here and I have these interests and you're here and you have those interests. So what naturally arises, I think, out of this practice of awakening, of kind of letting go of clinging, of seeing where we're holding on and finding that freedom and peace, is connection with all beings. And I certainly see this, and I think this is very much in the Buddha's teachings, is this isn't a kind of an individual path of waking up, that, you know, I find some, you know, personal individual freedom. Well, nice if I can, and nice if you can as well, but it's much broader than that. It's really about the ending of suffering. And ultimately, as we do let go of that sense of separation, what naturally arises is an open heart towards suffering wherever we see it. You know, whether it's the suffering that comes from war, or the suffering that comes from ignorance, or from racism, or from other kinds of violence, that falls away, and there's a natural opening of the heart and a wish to alleviate the suffering. And so the natural response is compassion, is loving kindness, is friendliness to suffering when we see it, when we experience it. I believe that this training, you know, what we're doing here really, and in similar settings to this, is a training of the heart and the mind. It's a kind of paying attention to what Ruth was talking about, of some of the habitual tendencies of the mind that get us into trouble, kind of where we do get hooked, and to see that we can let go. And it's the training in that letting go, as I was saying this morning, abandoning what's unskillful, abandoning the clinging and the hatred and the kind of the unskillful states of mind, and cultivating the good, cultivating wholesome states of mind that support connection, support love, support awakening. So I think that this training has enormous potential to help heal our world, you know, the suffering of the world around us. I mean, the world around us really is on fire. You know, there's just so much, I mean, there's such suffering. You know, how many wars are going on around the world? How many people, you know, are living in abject poverty while, you know, a few score people have more wealth than whole nations? You know, what's going on? What's going on to what we're doing to our planet, to our home? You know, through the way we're using resources and the lack of awareness and the lack of compassion, if you like, a lack of mindfulness in terms of how we're living on the earth. What I think these practices and these teachings bring is a way of working with our own responses in a skillful and compassionate way that can help us deal with the pain that's all around us, to meet that pain, to meet that suffering in a way where we don't have to be overwhelmed by it. You know, it's easy when we think of, you know, almost anything we look at right now. I mean, I'm going to talk a little bit in a minute about the racial justice situation in this country, but if it's easy just to think, this is too much, this is too painful, I don't even want to go there. And some of us may even have the privilege of it being able to kind of say, okay, I'm going to close my eyes to this, I don't need to really pay attention to this, or it's too painful for me to do that. It's so natural for us when something is painful to want to shut it off, to not go there. And yet, if we're going to heal our own hearts and help in the healing of the world, We really have to open to the suffering. We have to find our way into our own suffering. And we have to find a kind and loving way of being with the suffering and transforming it. And we can do the same in the world. And I'm not talking about it as being somehow saviors, but I'm talking about just bringing the wisdom and compassion of these teachings into helping heal the suffering of the world. So I'm going to talk about one specific area of suffering. It's one that I and others have looked at a lot more closely in this last year or so. And it's one of a number. It's not, but it I think is a really crucial one for us to pay attention to, and not in any way making other things that are going on unimportant or less important. But I want to just bring into our, you know, into the room in a kind of explicit way the suffering around race in our country today. And I want to acknowledge that in even bringing it up, it brings up difficult feelings. You know, it can bring up all sorts of ways in which we kind of like, you know, I don't want to go there. And yet it's it offers potential for healing our own hearts and also healing the suffering in our society and in our culture more broadly. Ruth this morning spoke about some of the killings, and I just want to just mention names and situations just to begin with, to give a frame, and invite you to just pay attention with great kindness to whatever is arising for you. So this is really just, it's a practice like other practices, to let as much as you can into your heart and meet, you know, whatever is arising with kindness and with awareness and with interest. I want to go back a couple of years and just recall the death of Trayvon Martin in Florida, who was killed by a neighborhood watch guy who felt, you know, fearful and didn't felt, you know, he responded in this way, and the suffering that came out of that for the family, for the community, for the wider society. Then about a year ago, and this is no way intended to be comprehensive, but just to kind of some of the more better known cases, examples over this last couple of years. Recalling the situation in Ferguson where Michael Brown was killed by a black man, African-American man, killed, shot by a white police officer. And, you know, there's some, you know, different interpretations about that killing, but one thing that's not in any doubt and that came out very clearly in the Department of Justice report is that the whole judicial system in that area and the whole police system was organized almost like a mafia, like a racket. You know, you arrest people, you fine them $100 when they can't pay, you double the fine. You know, somebody, African-American woman, had a $100 or so fine and went up to $5,000. She spent time in prison. I mean, all of this coming out of the situation, and it was almost like if you'd have heard that it was Alabama in 1954, you kind of might have said, okay. But this is, you know, this was Missouri in 2015. Moving to Staten Island, New York, where Eric Garner was selling loose cigarettes and was killed by police. Another African-American man killed by white police officers, choked to death. And you probably remember, you know, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. Then, again, not even necessarily all in chronological order, I was just bringing to mind the different cases. The 12-year-old boy in Cincinnati, Tamir Rice, with a toy pistol, shot by, again, an African-American boy, shot 12-year-old, shot by a white police officer. Freddie Gray in Baltimore, who was seemingly given a rough ride, you know, in a, we call them paddy wagons, but the wagons where you're taken off to the jail, and died soon afterwards. Again, you know, African American man, six police in that case, three were of color and three were white. Walter Scott, who was shot eight times in the back. All of these cases, the victim was unarmed, shot by a white, African-American man, shot by a white officer in North Charleston, South Carolina. Many of these are on video, which is a way we know about them today with the smartphone and the iPhone and all of that. So the question arises, you know, the kind of implicit question, you know, is it just happening now? You know, I mean, obviously we go where our minds go on that, you know. More recently, Sandra Bland arrested, thrown to the ground for basically a traffic stop. She died in custody, hanging 3 days after her arrest. Again, a black woman, in this case, a white officer. And then finally, just in the last few days, Gary Dubose in Cincinnati, shot by a white police officer for a minor, you know, stop for a minor traffic violation. Officer is now on charge for being charged with murder. And I put all of this out just to kind of say that something is happening. And I put it out in the spirit of inquiry and awareness and kindness. I'm not trying to say you should think this or you shouldn't think that, but we're faced with situations around us and we're called on to really to respond and ask ourselves, what is a wise and compassionate response to these situations? And I'll just say a few more things, just in terms of the context, and then a little about the history. You've probably heard about the studies that show that if two individuals apply for a job and one's named John or Michael and another's named Jamal, or, you know, kind of a name that kind of is identified with African-American men or women in this case, this is men, that the Johns get called back twice as often. You know, that's a study. So what's going on there? You might have heard that a white person with a criminal record has the same chance of getting a job with similar qualifications as a black person without a criminal record. So equal, but the white person has a criminal record and the black person, the person of color, doesn't. There were a number of studies in the Washington Post and other places earlier this year about the mortgage crisis in Prince George's County, and you know, some of the information coming out about that is, you know, is really interesting and disturbing. You know, that a woman of color is 2.5 times more likely to get a subprime mortgage than a white male. You know, so a mortgage with high interest rates and, you know, terms which are likely to lead to hugely greater payments and also much greater risk of foreclosure. So something is terribly wrong. I just put it that way without, you know, pointing any fingers at anybody at this stage. Something is terribly wrong. And one of the things that white people have a freedom to do that people of color don't have is to kind of put it out of our sight somewhat, you know, of turning the other way, because we're not faced with it on a day-to-day level. We can kind of say, oh yeah, that's really bad, but then we can look somewhere else. There was a woman at Wellesley College back 25 years ago, Peggy McIntosh, that spoke about white people having an invisible knapsack, of privileges. She named 50 ways in which she was privileged in comparison with African-American colleagues or friends, you know, that she could go into a store and not be followed around, you know, because she'd be suspected of shoplifting. Or if she stopped by the police, that she wouldn't presume that she was being stopped, you know, on the basis of her race. That she can look at TV programs and read newspapers and can be sure that people that she'll see will represent her race. You know, and she gave 50 of these examples. And the question that comes to me is, how do we work with, how do we bring mindfulness to areas of our life where we have the freedom not even to let them into our awareness? That's the kind of, that's why this is such a challenging area, and I think challenging particularly for white people, that when we're born into privilege, you know, of not having, just to take an example, here I am, you can probably tell from my accent that I wasn't born in West Covina or Amarillo, Texas. I came over here in my mid-20s, and I had the ability to, you know, take advantage of many, many freedoms that are available in this society, even though, you know, I hadn't been here for generations and generations. But I, by virtue of being white, I could just take those for granted. I never even questioned them until quite recently. And yet there are people whose forebears have been here for generations and generations and generations that don't have that same freedom. So how do, speaking to white people and white practitioners, how do we bring awareness to areas where of our life where there's an inherent lack of awareness, you know, because we're born into the privilege of having a white skin in a white dominated society, how do we actually see the privileges that we do have? How do we bring them into awareness? And I believe that we really need to make an effort. We really need to make a commitment to do that, because people of color don't have those freedoms. It's in their face every day of the week. And so I don't want to get too much into a lecture and invite us just back into the kind of into the space of a kind of a meditative space of just looking at how we hold our experience. How do we hold what comes up when you hear of this suffering or these forms of suffering? One of the things that in our community we've been doing over the last recent years, but more particularly as white board members, teachers, staff in the Insight Meditation community, is really trying to bring awareness to we call it a white awareness group of the privileges that we have and what we're not aware of, and how we can transform the suffering, our own suffering and the suffering of others, how we can be a force for healing in our community and in the wider community. One of the things that I've learned and I think had the freedom and maybe the privilege not to know until I really paid attention was how much the weight of history, you know, affects the current moment. You know, we think about, you know, having an African-American president. We think of, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and all the changes that have taken place and the kind of theory that we might be living in a colorblind society, or at least that kind of the idea, which I don't think is the truth. But it's very, very easy not to be aware of the weight of history. And one of the things I was unaware of was how important slavery was to the accumulation of white wealth. You know, in 7 cotton states, 1/3 of white income came from slavery. 1/4 of all white Southerners owned slaves. Cotton accounted for 59% of U.S. exports. And something that I wasn't aware of was that slaves were the single largest financial asset of property in the entire American economy. In 1860, just before the Civil War, slaves were worth more than all of America's manufacturing, all of the railroads, all of the productive capacity of the United States put together. So there's this history of 250 years of slavery, which was followed in the South by Jim Crow laws, where, African Americans were disenfranchised, were excluded, were marginalized. One of the ways in which black people were kept in their place was through lynchings. And there were almost 4,000 lynchings between 1877 and 1950. It's been called racial terror lynchings. One of the things that I wasn't aware of, too, was that I certainly thought of the New Deal as a very progressive, the legislation under Roosevelt in the 30s particularly. And I was unaware that African Americans were largely excluded from many of the benefits of the New Deal. Under the New Deal, old age insurance and unemployment insurance excluded farm workers and domestic workers. So in 1935, when FDR signed the Social Security Act, 65% of African Americans nationally and 70-80% in the South were ineligible for the benefits. So we think of that, I think of that as very progressive legislation, and yet it was this built-in, what I think of as built-in affirmative action for white people over the centuries. Between 1930, and I won't have a lot more statistics, but between 1930 and 1960, home ownership in the U.S. rose from 30-60%. So 1930 to 1960 went from 30-60%. Huge doubling of home ownership. But under the legislation of the New Deal, which was really a compromise between, white Southerners and Northerners, African Americans were largely excluded from the benefits of that home ownership. So as one writer put it, locked out of the greatest mass-based opportunity for wealth accumulation in U.S. history, African Americans who desired and were able to afford home ownership found themselves consigned to central city communities where their investments were affected by the self-fulfilling prophecies of the FHA appraisers. FHA is the Federal Housing Administration. Cut off from sources of new investment, their homes and communities deteriorated and lost value in comparison to those homes and communities that FHA appraisers seemed desirable. So if we look at history, we look at slavery, we look at Jim Crow era, we even look at the New Deal, there's a kind of a built-in exclusion that carries over from generation to generation, from decade to decade. So everything that we're experiencing now is really a product of that history. In Buddhism, we talk about causes and conditions. Everything comes out of causes and conditions. And these are the causes, or some of them, this is only just a little slice that I'm giving. These are the causes and conditions that kind of are the underpinning of exclusion, the whole redlining of neighborhoods, so they became, you know, run down and poor schools, and all of that is a product of all of that history. And, you know, and the killings, I think, are also a product of a certain way in which we look at each other, you know, where, you know, given all of these factors, you know, African-American young men particularly are looked on as, you know, the most likely to be committing crimes, and therefore the police go into situations, you know, loaded for bear, as it were, and ready, and, you know, trigger ready, you know, the gun ready to go off kind of thing. So how do we hold all of this, and how do we respond to it? I just want to finish with this piece, with saying that Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's written a really powerful recent book, a number of other books as well, he was quoted as saying, "The reason black people are behind is not because of now, it's because of then. There's a whole weight of history that we're living in and with." And I'd say again, as white people, it's very, very easy to close our eyes and have the privilege of looking away. And these teachings and these practices invite us to, and I'm saying here for now for white people, invite us in this case to open to the pain. What is it that I'm feeling right now? And it's different. It's a different kind of response, I believe, from African Americans. Perhaps it's more pessimism, it's more things are never going to change. Maybe it's anger and rage. You know, in among white people, I think there's more a kind of turning away, a shutting it off, a freedom to do that. So how do we hold these difficulties, these painful realities in our hearts? How do we become a source of healing, a force for healing, rather than for perpetuating suffering? Because the cycle has to end. You know, as Buddhism teaches, the cycle can always end right here, right now, with me. That with each one of us, we can say, I'm not going to keep on that suffering. I'm not going to keep perpetuating the anger or the hatred or the judgment. I'm going to pause, I'm going to breathe, I'm going to bring awareness, I'm going to allow myself to feel what I'm feeling. In the Buddhist tradition, there's kind of a figure of a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is, the words mean, bodhi means awakening and sattva means being. So a being of awakening is somebody who wakes up to the truth of things, but traditionally stays in the realm of suffering until all beings are liberated, until all beings are free. So it's a way of compassionately responding, of making our practice not just about my own awakening, but the awakening of all beings. And Jack Kornfield, in his book, The Wise Heart, speaks about what are the qualities of a bodhisattva? And I think what we're invited to be is bodhisattvas, is beings who, we're living in the world and we're committed to alleviating and ending the suffering of the world. And, you know, it doesn't mean that everybody has to be out on the streets or doing particular kinds of work, or we all need to be doing all of these issues. Probably we don't have the bandwidth, you know, and we do need to focus and we do need to make choices. So what is skillful, what is a skillful, wise way of responding to the suffering that is all around us. Jack says in his book, The Wise Heart, he describes three qualities of a bodhisattva or a spiritual warrior. He or she begins by acknowledging and accepting the truth of their situation or the truth of the situation. Just taking refuge in reality, in the truth. Right now, we might have different language for what I shared with you, and I'm not trying to put, as I said, I'm not trying to put forward a particular view, but there's a truth that's out there that we have the possibility of opening to, of recognizing and saying, yes, this is true, this is really painful, and it's true. Can I open my heart to this? The bodhisattva faces the truth, turns towards the difficulties, and shines the light of understanding on them. So in this situation, we look at what's going on all around us and say, you know, depending on who we are and where we're positioned, you know, in this case in race, terms of race, but it might be in terms of gender or sexual orientation or religion or any other group identity, how do we experience what we're seeing? How do we bring awareness with kindness and inquiry to the world as we're seeing it? How do we take that in? That's the first quality of the bodhisattva, to acknowledge and accept the truth of the situation. The second is to work to find peace within ourselves by engaging in a training or practices to let go of painful and afflictive states and develop positive ones. What we talked about today as abandoning the unskillful and cultivating the good. So these are the practices we're engaged in today to work to find peace within ourselves, to hold what is painful and difficult, and to let that transform our hearts, let that be a place of awakening for us. And the third quality of a bodhisattva is to envision actions and a path of freedom for themselves, for their community, and for the world. As Jack says, envisioning has enormous power. With our vision and imagination, we can help create the future. Envisioning sets our direction, marshals our resources, makes the unmanifest possible. So envisioning actions and a path of freedom for ourselves, for the community, for the world. So if we look at a situation, we look at the situation of racial justice and the painful situation in our country right now, what does this call on you, on me, on any of us to do? What is it that we're able to do? What is it that our heart calls us to do to respond? And what's really important, I think, is that it not come from a place of should, you know, some sense of, oh, I should be doing this. I should be working to save the planet. I should be working to do more to heal, you know, injustice, racial injustice or social injustice. But to have it come from a sense of connecting with the suffering and that with those who are suffering, and asking ourselves, what can I do? What can I do to be a force for healing and for ending suffering? Thinking of the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, when he says, I've seen too much hate to want to hate. And every time I see it, I say to myself, hate is too great a burden to bear. Somehow we must be able to stand up against our most bitter opponents and say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. But be assured that we'll wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will appeal to your heart and conscience so that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. I find that just an extraordinary, it's a heart as wide as the world, a heart that can take in the suffering and transform that suffering, like the Tonglen meditation in the Tibetan tradition, where you take in the world's suffering and you really transform it within your own heart, and you send it back into the world as love and as peace and as connection and as freedom. So the invitation, I think, is to, as with the difficult person, is to train our hearts to be open, to take in what it's hard to take in, to see where we're shutting down, to see where we're going dark, as it were, we're kind of removing ourselves from a situation. And that's not to say we don't remove ourselves. Sometimes the heart needs to step back. We need to take a space to be able to breathe and rebuild resilience. And I think that's a very wise response. But it's in order to be able to step back in and say, there's suffering. There's suffering all around us. How do I respond? How do we respond? And I think there's nothing, I find there's nothing that's more healing and with greater potential than the practices that we're doing here. That is, of training ourselves in awareness, in learning that we can be in the fire. You know, maybe we have to go step by step and learn that we can take the heat, but learn that we can be there, that we can cultivate a heart large enough to hold our most painful experiences. And it's through practice that we build, I think, the confidence to know and the trust to know that we can do this. You know, as the Buddha said, you can do this. If you couldn't do this, I wouldn't ask you to do it. I love the way he says that, or at least the way it's come down to us. I don't think he was speaking English. So. But we can transform our hearts, and we can work to heal our world. And so how do we do that? And one of the ways we do it is we do it together. You know, it's not something we do on our own. We wake up together, we work together, we support each other in our waking up and in our healing.